Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Esquire Coaching Radio, where we help attorneys achieve unparalleled personal and professional success. And now here's your host, Anne Jenrette Thomas.
Welcome everyone to the Esquire Coaching Radio Show. It's such a pleasure to be here with all of you today. As you know, Esquire Coaching is a national coaching and consulting firm that is dedicated to empowering lawyers to happily succeed in the business of law. To that end, we discuss the full range of topics from building business to getting a job to work-life balance and everything in between. Today we have a very special guest who's going to talk to us about the lawyer as leader, how to plant people and grow justice. Now, this is a topic that is very near and dear to my heart. You know, throughout history, lawyers have been at the forefront of advancing social change and making the world a better place. In fact, it's one of the reasons why I decided to go to law school in the first place was because I was inspired by Thurgood Marshall and, you know, all the people who were involved in the civil rights movement. Well, today's show and our guest is going to offer practical guidance on developing your leadership skills, explore current social justice issues, and profile leaders in the legal community who are at the cutting edge leading change. So our special guest is Dr. Artika Tyner, and she is a passionate educator, author, and sought-after speaker and advocate for justice. At the University of St. Thomas College of Education Leadership and Counseling, Dr. Tyner serves as a public policy leadership professor. She trains graduate students to serve as social engineers who create new inroads to justice and freedom. Dr. Tyner is committed to empowering others to lead within their respective spheres of influence. She provides leadership development and career coaching for young professionals. She's also developed leadership educational materials for K through 12 students, college graduate students, faith communities, and nonprofits. Additionally, Dr. Tyner teaches leadership coursework on ethics, critical reflection, and organizational development. Her research focuses on diversity and inclusion, community development, and civil rights. Dr. Tyner has presented her research and conducted leadership training programs both nationally and internationally. Dr. Tyner leads by example by organizing policy campaigns, fostering restorative justice practices, developing social entrepreneurship initiatives, and promoting assets-based community development. She serves as a global citizen by supporting education, entrepreneurship, and women's leadership initiatives in Africa. And I am honored to have read her book, The Lawyer as Leader, How to Plant People and Grow Justice. Welcome, Dr. Tyner.
Thank you for the warm welcome. I'm excited to be here and be a part of this learning community.
Excellent. We're so excited to have you here. And before we begin, I just want to remind our listeners that there will be time at the end of our show to ask questions. Simply call 347-838-8719 and press 1 to get in line. That's 347-838-8719 and press 1 to get in the line. So let's dive right in. So tell us a little bit about your background and who you are.
Well, for me, my background is pretty simple. I always had a passion related to justice, the sense of how could I build and strengthen my community, how could I advance change, and also the part that's been near and dear to my heart from since I can remember is being an advocate for children and helping to ensure that all children have access to a quality education, but more importantly, to discover their leadership and their gifts and talents. So who am I? Just a person who's been committed to building and fostering change and being a part of my community. So my first love was education. I initially wanted to become a high school English teacher. But lo and behold, as I started student teaching, that's when I really started to see some of the disparities that we talk about today related to literacy issues and simple daily barriers that young people face related to housing, access to food, what can we do to ensure that the next generation would have the tools that they need to compete in a globalized world? So I think that was my first kind of righteous indignation. How could I make a difference related to education? And I knew that the law was a tool and mechanism to leverage power. So lo and behold, I attended law school to gain some new tools to fight for those children who were in my classroom, and also just to fight to make the world a more just place.
Your passion is so evident, and you know, I love that you started by wanting to advocate on behalf of children. So talk to us about how this morphed and sparked your interest regarding leadership development for lawyers.
Well, once I became a lawyer, one thing that happened right away is that people had an expectation that I would be a lead problem solver, that I would be the leader in the room. So there was automatically this type of deference that was given to me. But then I realized something. I had a wonderful experience and had the training as a lawyer, but I never really focused on or had an opportunity in law school to develop core leadership competencies. So that's when I started to think about, is there a missing link? There's this expectation, and there was even this desire with me coming to law school of wanting to serve as a leader in my community, leveraging my influence through service. So servant leadership really resonated with me. How could that passion for service then compel me to lead in the process of change? So finding this voice related to leadership and unveiling my research in this arena was really something that unveiled both by necessity, but also I think it was the completion of my education. So I actually ended up pursuing a doctorate in leadership to delve into this question of, what is the role of lawyers as leaders? I know you mentioned Justice Thurgood Marshall, who's also served as inspiration for me, or also his mentor, Charles Hamilton Houston, who gave a simple notion that a lawyer is either a social engineer or a parasite on society. All of those are kind of notions related to leadership. So that's when I started to think more about how can we teach principles of leadership. What would that look like? What would the curriculum, what would that include? So that sent me on a research journey over a four-year period and still emerging today on what does that type of leadership look like? Because we tend to, when we think about lawyers, we just say, leadership in corporate settings to prevent something like another Enron or some type of moral crisis. But I think it's much bigger than that. How do we leverage leadership to create a world that we all can live in and thrive and do our best?
I wholeheartedly agree with you. And you're absolutely right. Lawyers get this automatic deference and are considered leaders off the bat without having to earn it whatsoever. And you mentioned something very interesting, which is that we do not teach core leadership competencies in law school. I was wondering if you could just elaborate a bit on what those core leadership competencies are.
Well, I mean, one that usually lays a foundation is vision. Because that's that simple notion, without a vision, the people perish. So where are we headed? When we look at law, law is the foundation of our society, whether we're starting off with the notion of we the people, who are the people? What does equal citizenship look like? So as we're asking that those types of questions, it's the foundation and underpinning of democracy. So when I think about leadership and leadership qualities is first for lawyers that vision of what would make democracy come alive. What does it need to look like today to protect the rights of people? You also need some of those technical skills. Of course, the legal research, writing, analytical skills that we build just naturally through law school and that experience. You also need the ability to work with others. I know law school typically is that sense of competing a bit. You know, you have that force curve and everyone wants the A and you're working very independently. But is there a notion where we need more collaboration? And for me, that's been the crux of my work, especially related to community engagement. Knowing then that leadership just doesn't lie with the hands of a lawyer. There's also community members that need to be a part of this process of building that vision that I talked about earlier. Other professionals. One of my first teaching experiences was in an interprofessional center. So we brought together social workers, psychologists, and lawyers to problem solve around some of the social justice issues of our time. So I think that collaborative nature is also key as well.
I love that. It's so innovative, you know, the approach that you're taking. Now, how do you train your students to become leaders, and not just leaders, but change agents?
Well, for me, one of the first questions that I ask my students, and a question that I also ask of myself, is what is in your hands to make a difference in the world? That moves beyond of, yes, you need your legal training, yes, you need to pass the bar and get your first job, but really, once you have this legal training, you have a new set of tools. So what will you do with them? So all of a sudden, I decided to change the classroom, flip the classroom in some ways. That's the way some educators call it. But instead of just saying, we'll be here and we'll study some books and some course materials, read some statutes, some case law, how about we engage directly with the community? What are the legal issues and challenges that they're facing? So that changes, and when I say flipping the classroom, all of a sudden the classroom becomes a learning laboratory, a place where as we're learning about different theories and practices, how does it apply to an issue like ending mass incarceration? When we know that there's over 2 million people incarcerated in the United States, how do you grapple with that as a policy issue, as a legal issue? How do you deal with the racial disparities related to that issue? So all of a sudden we're asking questions and working to develop solutions. But once again, not in just a silo where you say the lawyers have all the answers. Most of the time, my students and I were out in the field. You may be at a local coffee shop asking people what's happening, what are some of their experiences, at a town hall forum, at the Capitol. So also knowing that our community, our level of engagement as an educational institution goes beyond the four walls of our campus. So on the ground engagement has been key.
On-the-ground engagement, and it makes so much sense, and yet that's something, you know, it's a very grassroots take. It's a very grassroots perspective, and I think that is something that has been lost on the legal profession, largely because of the status of being a lawyer and how it's been perceived over the years. So, Dr. Tyner, talk to us about some of the current projects that you and your students are working on.
Well, I already mentioned the mass incarceration piece. I mean, that's always been at the forefront of my work because personally in seeing and watching the war on drugs unfold, I saw firsthand as, you know, moms and dads, brothers, sisters, they entered into this trajectory into the prison system. But oftentimes I think the one thing that we don't like to talk about is that people then return back home. And I talk about it in the sense of they return back home with a scarlet letter and that being S, felon. And the thing that we still need to talk about is the challenges related to reentry. If you have over 65 million people with some type of arrest or criminal record, how does that influence their ability to obtain a job for housing? How does it impact their quality of life? How does it impact community development? So the problem-solving piece goes beyond the fact of, yes, there's convictions, yes, there's people in prison, but what happens next? So that's where I challenge my students to be the social engineers. So part of this work has been students conducting research and our team working on how do we restore voting rights to people who have a felony or whose rights have been restricted in some way. How do we also look at the jobs piece? Because oftentimes we say, well, there's a racial jobs gap, but in some ways that data of what we're seeing related to that gap mirrors some of the data that we're seeing related to the arrest records, criminal convictions, and those collateral consequences as well. So that's one area that we've been problem solving to say that there's more to the story. But also coupled with that is our obligation. When I talked about being an advocate for children, a very pressing issue is a school-to-prison pipeline. Because for me, as I think about it, and I recall, you know, being a child, and I can tell you one of my greatest faults was, and you can probably tell from this interview, is I love to chat. So I was chatting and talking at every chance that I had. But today, what does that look like? Today, that could translate into disorderly conduct. Today, that could translate into when I was asking questions the why of the teacher, insubordination. And those types of behaviors then being criminalized. And what does that mean long-term to the future of young people if they're entering into this trajectory of the pipeline to prison through the school system from referrals either through school disciplinary issues or zero tolerance policies? So we have to raise some questions there when we have over 3.3 million children annually being referred out of the classroom. What happens next? And how do we look at and think about what policies do we need, like restorative justice, for example, to deal with conflict management, to help bring young people together, to become problem solvers themselves? Can we create other alternatives? So my students and I have also conducted extensive research to think about how can we dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline in a very practical way and also raise awareness. For instance, one thing that most people don't think about, they say, well, if a young person gets into trouble with the law, it's not a big deal. Their record, poof, magically disappears at the age of 18. And in most circumstances, that's completely inaccurate, that young person would still have a juvenile record, and depending on what state they're in, could have some real ramifications. So those are the types of things that we work on, not just to talk with lawyers about these issues, talk to community members and children who are impacted by these issues, also bring together and build a coalition with educators, with law enforcement. How do we problem solve around these issues in a holistic way? And then finally, the project that we've been working on for a number of years is called the Campaign for Prison Phone Justice. This particular campaign is focused specifically on making sure that the costs of prison phone calls are fair, reasonable, and just. Because for me, I had no idea. I thought a prison phone call, that's just... But as we started to look more closely, seeing call costs exceed $15 to $20 for a 15-minute call, it leaves you to say, what is actually happening? I know for me, if someone calls internationally, you don't pay that amount for an international call. You don't pay it for right. any other type of collect call. So what exactly is the issue? And for that particular issue, it was seeing then that there's just about a handful of companies that enter into private contracts with prisons. And in return for entering into that contract, the companies then pay commissions to the Department of Corrections of that respective state or to that county. So in light of that, if we take Minnesota specifically, you see commissions that exceed about 50% that yield about $2 million annually. But you have to say, who's paying those amounts? It's the family members who are impacted. It's the 15,000 children in Minnesota who have an incarcerated parent who aren't able to afford to be able to keep in contact, which is a vital human right, but also a key part of just humanity to keep families connected and keep them together. So we've been working both at a national level of advocacy through the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, and then also locally to help bring forth changes as well. So once again, it's students on the ground rolling up their sleeves, using their legal skills, but also developing as leaders to use their voice for justice.
Wow, this is so fascinating and so exciting. You know, this to me is real lawyering, to really be able to get in there and innovate and create change. And I usually hear the term 360 in the corporate environment, and listening to you, it inspired me to think that the approach you take is a real 360. It's one that comprehensively involves everyone that is impacted. And helping everyone be involved in being part of the solution. So I really commend you on that. Now, what inspired you to write your first leadership book, The Lawyer as Leader?
For me, I really think it was a calling, because even with pursuing my graduate studies in the doctorate program, I initially was reading an interview from W.E.B. Du Bois. It was an interview that was related to the soul of Black folks. And he said that he would earn his doctorate to help his people race with the world. It really resonated with me. And when I opened it up, and read that interview, I had no idea even what a dissertation was. And honestly, the only folks that I had known were doctors. I was thinking about the MDs because I was a first-generation college student. So this was all new to me. But lo and behold, I found myself applying for a doctorate program. And very early on, I said, I want to focus on lawyers as leaders. So when I think about what inspired me to write the leadership book, is I went on that journey through the studies of within that particular program and starting to profile some of the lawyers who were engaging in social justice and civil rights work today in innovative ways, I saw that there was a missing link, that there were a few books, not many, that were starting to explore this notion of leadership specifically for lawyers. But overall, they were focusing on leadership in either a more general sense or specifically related to corporate issues. And I wanted to do something different. I was inspired as well by even the words that are in the model rules of professional conduct that's published by the ABA, that sense of a lawyer as a public citizen. So I wanted to look at lawyering beyond what we had already put in the box. You're either a trial lawyer, maybe you're a public defender or a prosecutor, but is there a level of influence, a level of consciousness that every lawyer should have? And that's what inspired me to write the book, to say exactly what that is, in the sense of lawyers as leaders, picking up the mantle of leadership and saying it's not just about laws and policies alone, but it's about how those laws and policies impact the daily lives of people. And are we creating a world that we can say with confidence that we're passing on to the next generation that will be a better world, a world where we can address what I saw in that classroom related to what we call today of, you know, the achievement gap, or what I'd refer to it as is the opportunity gap. How do we get on the ground to use our legal training to create and manifest change? So that's what inspired me to write. There was nothing else out there quite like that, to give that type of message that you came to law school to make a difference, I came to law school to make a difference, here's a blueprint, here's a guide on how to do that.
I love that. Let me just interrupt our interview for a second. Things are going so well, but I want to just remind our listeners that if you have a question for Dr. Tyner, this is the time to call in. Call 347-838-8719 and press 1 to get in the line. That is 347-838-8719 and press 1 to get in the line. All right, while we're waiting to see if anyone calls in with their questions, I wanted to just ask you, where did some of the ideas that you have in the book come from?
Well, initially, the ideas emerged out of my work and my research related to the work of Charles Hamilton Houston and that concept of social engineering. And I read in one of the books, if I can recommend it for our listening audience, is Groundwork, written by Dr. McNeil. It really gives a blueprint, an outline on how Charles Hamilton Houston not only engaged his students in the classroom, those students like Justice Thurgood Marshall, Oliver Hill, and Spotswood Robinson, but what tools did he use? Because he had one simple mission and vision, which was to bury Plessy versus Ferguson, that case that says separate can be equal. So how did he outline that path? What exactly did it look like? So I've been an avid reader, anything related to Charles Hamilton Houston, because he laid a blueprint for what we call today of Brown versus Board of Education. So his work definitely has inspired me. And secondly, Marion Wright Edelman. I sit on the advisory board for Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, and definitely seeing her work as a key foundation of thinking about lawyering as a tool to advance social change, I can't think of a better example. And she actually wrote the foreword for my book. And one of the things that she talked about in that foreword was not, these are things that we could do, like creating access to healthcare services for all children or improving, you know, access to early childhood education. These are the things that she said we must do. And I'll just read just one brief quote. She says, "We can and must chart a new course for America's future if it is ever to live up to its promise." So I think a part of that is, how do we do that? And that's that question of what's in your hands to make a difference in the world. A part of it's going to be our legal training and using our legal skills to represent those who wouldn't otherwise have their voices heard in the courtroom, to change the policies that we see creating inequities. So my inspiration really was the work of those two, of Charles Hamilton Houston and Marion Wright Edelman.
That is so inspiring. And, you know, it makes a lot of sense when you're talking about it. Now, what about the process of publishing this book? Is there any insights or special aspects about the process that you'd like to reflect on?
Yes, I would love to get a message to any inspiring author out there, is that it definitely will take some tenacity. Because originally when I was starting to talk about some of these ideas of leadership for lawyers, the immediate reaction that I received was, well, those are soft skills. How is that relevant to the practice of law? And I would say that it's an essential skill, the sense of how can you develop the competencies that we've already talked about to be able to effectively lead, to build new partnerships, to think innovatively, and to grapple with the challenges of our time. That's going to also take some creative problem solving and bringing people together. So for me, a big piece of it was developing a market for this type of endeavor, for this type of research, because it goes far beyond the book. My vision is to build a leadership institute that focuses specifically on training, and I'll say a specific population, young people, on how to engage in social justice advocacy. So when I look at the process, if I could give any advice for anyone, is to be able to build a platform for your work, for it to fit into a larger message for your vision on what you'd like to see to change in the world.
Oh, wow. That is so inspiring. Now, tell us, what's one small action that each of us can take to make a difference in the world?
For me, that small action, once again, would start with children. So I would say one small action that every attorney, every community member can endeavor on is to be an advocate for children. So as we look at just the experiences of children in any given day, and this is data from the Children's Defense Fund, that 2,857 high school students drop out, 4,028 children are arrested, and 16,244 public school students are suspended on any given day. So I don't know about you, but that gives me a sense that there's a dire need to make sure that we're supporting the growth and development for children, not just to learn in the classroom, but to thrive for a lifetime. So if I gave one small action, it would be, can we take the time, each of us, to mentor a young person? Can we take the time to even read to a young person, to promote a love for learning and for literacy? So I think if we're looking ahead to the future, that's that sense of Whitney Houston talked about. I believe the children are our future. We have to make that investment now.
Oh, beautiful. I think that's such a powerful, powerful recommendation for all of us to not only give back, but really step into our own leadership as well. So thank you so much for joining us today and sharing all of your wonderful insights. I'd love to, for you to share with our listeners, how can they reach you and how can they get a copy of your book?
I would encourage all of our listeners, you can follow me through social media, through Twitter, it's Dr. Artika Tyner. You can also follow me on Facebook as well, on Planting People, Growing Justice. And as far as additional resources, you can go to my website, which is www.artikatyner.com. So that's ArtikaTyner.com. And you can also, there's a link to the book. You can purchase a copy of the book right through my website as well.
Fantastic. This has been such a joy and a real inspiration. It's a reminder for me about the importance of all of us as lawyers to really step up as leaders. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Anne, for the opportunity to share.
Our pleasure, our pleasure. So, listeners, let's keep this conversation going. Have you now become inspired to take up your leadership level to the, you know, your leadership game to the next level? Are you finding ways to give back to the community and truly become an agent for change? If so, share your comments on our social media sites. You can find all of them on our website, www.esquirecoaching.com. Let us know what you think about leadership and about today's show on Facebook, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Our next episode next week, we'll be speaking with Floyd Holloway regarding the Institute for Inclusion in the legal profession. So if you have any questions for us about next week's topic or this week's topic, feel free to email us at info@esquirecoaching.com. Until then, be well, everyone.